This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Hi everyone, pleased to be here. I thought we'd get this more exciting by getting you to interrupt me and ask questions as I go along, because it keeps me on my toes. So don't hesitate. Any time you want to hone in and have a go, please do so. So what I'm going to try and do today, if I'm not interrupted too much, is to tell you about the Conservative plans for welfare reform and to the work system. And I must say that suddenly seems to be all too real with the election date coming at us like a train. But I think it's worth just saying, before discussing specific policies and strategies, that I've come round to the view it's not really the main issue in this area. I think what we really need in this area is a level of consistency in terms of delivery and a steady build-up of capability. I think that's far more important than the kind of the policies that seem to waft back and forth on a weekly basis. The weakness in this area, when you think about it, has actually been the astonishing political turnover there's been. I mean, I was first came into this area just a little bit over 3 years ago, and in that time I've either worked with or not worked with four secretaries of state and five ministers of state, which is really an astonishing figure. I mean, I thought I was the newcomer. I'm now the oldest of old stages in this area. And the reality is, to effect a revolution in this area, you have to have a coherence in terms of where you're driving to for a good decade if you want to achieve anything substantial at all. So I'm not going to make any apologies for going back to the heart of the issue, because it's the central challenge, and it has not changed in the 3 years since I've been involved, since I wrote my report. We need to get a substantial number of the people who are currently economically inactive back into the workforce, and whether they've been on incapacity benefit, whether they've been on JSA, whether they've been on loan parent support systems, or whether they've moved to the new ESA. Even in the good times, we were looking at more than 4 million people who were dependent, and now in this recession, we're looking at 5 million plus at least another million who are looking for work but probably can't be bothered to claim. I think the arguments have become very simple on this, which they probably weren't a decade ago, which is that work is actually good for people, and I think the Waddle and Burton summation of all the research just made that fact absolutely crystal clear. Whether they're disabled or whatever, work is good for them, and not working is associated with poor well-being. The situation clearly is appalling for the taxpayer, having that many dependents. The direct fiscal cost of people on IB is, on my sums, £25 billion a year. And that's excluding all the on costs in terms of the burden on services. And there's estimates taking it into the 70, 80 billion plus figure. And I think the other thing which has been, I think it is being discussed now in different terms, but it is really rather bad for society to have a large group of dependent people. And we're beginning to see intergenerational effects now that the welfare state's been with us for 60 plus years. We're seeing seeing the effects of reinforcing poverty, and we're seeing, I wouldn't be surprised, although I'm not a social scientist, a lot of the antisocial behaviour coming out of that kind of dependency. Now, my own position is slightly odd. I mean, you could say it's very odd, because I wrote my original report for the government, and it was accepted by the government. And it's therefore moving steadily in the direction that was recommended 3 years ago. And to be absolutely honest, I think that is a really valuable and important thing that's happened, because it means that a lot of the groundwork has been put in the last 3 years, along the direction of travel which Labour has been going and Conservatives will also go. The Welfare Reform Act is now in place, so no new legislation is required by an incoming Conservative government, if there is to be one. The new commissioning strategy is in place. So the rebuilding of the welfare to work industry is now well underway. There is, of course, one new factor, and that is the impact of the recession, which has got big impacts, clearly, on unemployment and on the prospects for youngsters. But that means that we have to do two things at once, which we didn't before, which is firstly to tackle the economically inactive, but also to help the cyclically unemployed. And the Conservative plans really were restructured to take that necessity into account. I think the central difference, the central change and difference between what the government is planning and what the Conservatives are planning is that we want to introduce a single programme for all of these different initiatives, which we're calling the Work Programme. And essentially that absorbs the Flexible New Deal, Pathways, and the provision for the people coming off incapacity benefit onto ESA. And the aim is to scrap what has been a multiplicity of programmes. I think you can rather unkindly count about 32 different programmes today, although some of those are phasing out. But nevertheless, I think that is the figure. We want to try and, I mean, everyone says they'll get rid of them all and be one. I mean, we just try and get them down, consolidate them as fast as we possibly can into, and essentially what we're trying to do there is get rid of the categorisation by what benefit people happen to have been categorised by the state. Because if we can get everyone into one programme, that means that it will start to allow the providers to start to individualise their service around what the particular needs of individuals are, rather than looking at what particular benefit they've come off. So the implication is that we're going to scrap, more than an implication we've actually declared, we will scrap Flexible New Deal, although another way of looking at that is that we're going to dramatically widen it. And I think the logic of that came out of the fact that when we looked at FND, it looks a rather odd, an increasingly odd programme. It was devised effectively for the people who were cycling around the system. And there weren't that very many of those. There's about 250,000, best estimates. Very hard to pull that figure out. Say 250,000 of them. And it was done as a taster towards building this bigger industry, able to take financial risk and build consortia. But when the recession happened, you suddenly got all the cyclically unemployed suddenly coming into the group. So suddenly it dramatically widened, although the estimates of exactly how big it was FND was going to be have gone up and down a bit, much to the frustration of some of the providers. The second thing that's been happening is the introduction of the test for people whether they're eligible to go on to ESA. Whether it's people who've come off IB and have been retested or people newly coming on. Many more people than expected are going straight back onto JSA rather than onto ESA, and there was an expect, and I think there's a substantial move into JSA, but the reality is there's no difference in the problem of those people, whether they're reclassified as ESA or JSA. If you've been on IB for a long time, you really do have a very great problem of getting back into the workforce, and you need a lot of resource and energy to do it. So it suddenly didn't make sense to have one set of programs based on what they're calling Investor Save, and one set of programs doing FND for what is essentially a semi-arbitrarily divided group of people. Who will need very similar support. So in our policy, with one, everyone will transfer into the into the single program. There'll be different timings of that depending on need and actually depending on as we get wiser into the people who've really got the problems. Clearly, as we do get wiser, if we can, because there's a lot of debate about how good anyone is at assessing people when they walk in the door whether they're going to have a problem. But we certainly know that we can move people who have been on IB quickly into the provider market, because they will have problems if they've been out for 3, 4, 5, 8 years. They're going to have problems and they need a lot of support, so we get them in very quickly. I don't say on day one, but certainly within 3 months. We'll want to get the people who are cyclers in, and by them I mean the figure's been slightly disguised by a new deal, because people have been going from a short period of work into unemployment and into JSA, then into a new deal, and then you're recategorised and back again and cycling around. These are this 250,000. I think we can treat that. We should be isolating those and we will isolate those and get them very rapid movement through to the providers. We'll move the people who've been cyclically unemployed more slowly. Those people know what they're doing in the workplace and they can move under their own steam. So perhaps for a year or so, we'll leave them to achieve what they'll achieve on their own. And we'll move the youngsters at 6 months. I mean, that was at one stage much faster than the government's plan. The government then moved it down to 6 months themselves. The other big difference of the work programme is that we want the measurement to be sustained position in the world of work. And there is two quite radical changes involved in saying that. Let's say that the period we've talked about is between 1 and 3 years of in the world of work being looked after. And it means that the providers are going to have to worry far more about in-work support, relationships with employers, and also the training elements that person needs to really lock themselves in to the world of work. But the second is a more mechanical effect, and that is that rather than what happens at the moment, you go to your provider, get put into work, do 13 or now 26 weeks, lose the job, go right back to the beginning, start the whole process again. You're still, in this model, associated, or the person responsible is your provider. So you fall out of work on week 27 or week 53, whatever the period is. You're going back to your provider, so you have that continuity and build up. And that is a big change and implies quite a different business model for providers. And indeed, when we negotiate with providers to put in this work program, getting this right, getting the definition of what we mean by sustainability will be quite a big issue, and one that the providers will be modelling very carefully, because it implies a lot more in terms of volume. The thing that we would go wholeheartedly for, in a way that the present government has gone half-heartedly for, is the payment by results model. And the key to making that work is differential payments and making sure that the more difficult people to get into the workforce, the providers are paid a lot for, because they will have to invest much more in those people. And again, this is the other area which will be tough to get right and will be what the negotiation with providers is all about. The way we can do that, of course, and the way we have to do that is because of what's called the Dell-Amey switch. One can spend a long time describing the Dell-Amey switch. I'm sure most of you know it. Some of you have forgotten it, and a handful maybe have avoided it, thankfully, through your lives. But just to summarise, what all it means is that the two pockets of money that the government has kept religiously or dogmatically apart can be used together. So if you as a provider, invest a certain amount in a program, effectively your program to help someone, you can be rewarded out of saved benefit payments in future. So there's that's the payment mechanism, which is, and I kind of drove it through, I had to drive it through, it was quite contested at the time, on the basis that I thought government would never find money for helping people, and that was a good judgment, even in good times. In these bad times, I mean, the austere times we're facing, you know, it's going to mean that this is virtually the only growing industry in the country for a bit, I should think, because it means that to the extent that the provider community has appetite and capital to put behind people, there's a payment mechanism which can be as large as the providers are successful. The implication, of course, is that that those providers are going to need capital resources. And I'm really pleased to be hearing that providers now are actively going around talking to venture capital companies, investment banks, banks, and looking for that capital. And I think that's the most promising thing that that I've been hearing. Clearly, you can't do Dalaimi for absolutely everyone, because what it rests on is a knowledge of the counterfactual. You've got to say, if that person would have got into work anyway, you know, there's no way we can spend, you know, X thousands of pounds rewarding a provider who's just achieved what would have happened anyway. Well, I certainly wouldn't like to go and argue the point with the Treasury if one would. So we have to pull out the categories where we know more or less what the counterfactual is. And there are basically three. There's the people coming off IB. We know that the people coming off IB, or people on IB, find it extraordinarily hard to get a job. And in fact, the decay rate of that group is running at around 2%. For every 100 people on IB, only 2 of them will go off IB that year. So we know that figure. So whether those people have gone on to JSA or ESA, we can quite comfortably say anything over 2% that the provider achieves, they can be very substantially rewarded. And the second group, I think, are the, and we've announced, are the cyclers, which I've talked about just earlier. That's the group. If someone's been cycling around the system in the last 5 years, probably done 1 year out of the five, that's effectively an 80%, Amy, because clearly if they could only do 1 year in five in the last easy 5 years, they're going to find it at least as hard to do the equivalent. So again, that's a group that we've got a pretty good handle on the counterfactual. The other area that is easy to say and difficult to do is to allow the providers to get on with it in the way that they want to, and that's being called the black box. And you give a politician a black box and it becomes grey before you can shut your eyes and spit, because politicians all love to fiddle. And so these poor providers get told, yes, you'll have a black box. And then they say, but you have to see everyone once a week, and you have to spank them if they do this. And you have, by the way, you know. So it soon becomes a set of programs. And indeed, that's what happened in Australia. They got more and more, instructive on what the providers have to do. So keeping the purity of the black box will, I think, be a political job on its own for the next 5 years, just so that the providers can get on and show us what they can do. Because I think what we're looking for in this process is for the providers to actually create the systems in a free way to do it. And that's a very different approach than what I think this government has usually used outside provision for, which is much more a price discovery process. You know, they say they define precisely what they want, and then they try and get the cheapest price for it. We're looking much more for, you know, this is the outcome we want, you do it in the way that is most efficient for you, and we'll pay up. And I think it's also a philosophy of how does one trial things? And we've had, there's the old joke, which everyone has heard and repeated, about how many pilots the DWP has had. And, whether it's British Airways or Ryanair, I think it's got some more pilots now than British Airways, but this is a madness, this state-orchestrated pilot, because if you want to discover what works best, say what your outcome is, tell the industry to get on with it, and they will pilot 1,000 times more than the state can do, and they will be able to reach judgments on what their experience was in an infinitely more sophisticated way. Because, as you know, when you run a pilot, the first year you don't know what the hell you're doing, so your figures are awful. Second year you begin to see, so your figures may average up. Third year, actually, you might get it. Now, when you look at the pilot as a whole, it may show very little, but you as the manager of that pilot know exactly what you've achieved when you've got it to work. And that allows you to go on and apply those lessons. That's how business works. And that's the system that I want to see if I'm doing the job, rather than these state-run pilots. That's a bit of a rant. the transition clearly will be tough to do. I mean, actually, to introduce this program in the first round, and there's going to, because I mean, the issue being that we don't really know how to price the hardest to help. I don't think we really know that. So we're going to have to find some kind of soft start, and I can't give away too much on that because that's going to be quite commercial. My own view, for what it's worth, is that I much prefer to have information about the kind of volumes people can do when we throw money at it than the exact pricing parameters. And I think that is how I would like to drive the soft start, much more around volumes. And we may have to protect the state from abuse of that, obviously, through, you know, maybe some margin caps or something. But that's the way I'm thinking anyway. So how do we do it? I hope, but this is something that clearly we'll see, is that we can just pick up the process of the FND2 and transform it into the work program and then not lose very much time at all in getting the provision. I think the FND2 covers about 40% of the country. So, and then we would have to go back into FND1 and see which FND1 providers would be keen to widen their mandate and couldn't widen their mandate in terms of the capital available. So that would be the stages by which we go, and then clearly we can start pulling in, as they come up, some of these other programs so that we've got them. No one's interrupted me. I'm probably talking too fast. We've got a different approach to youth. I talked in the beginning about how the government copied our 6 months, but actually that wasn't the heart of what we were proposing, because we thought it was a very odd thing to do, is to create these extra programs for youngsters and just shove them in. And there are some good programs there, but there's actually an awful lot of not, you know, some local authority just, you know, get the people doing something programs. And it seemed to us a very peculiar thing to want to do with your youngsters at this absolutely critical stage of their lives and careers, that one just used up their time. If there is a bit of downtime in the economy, or even a lot of downtime in the economy, the best thing we can do with their youngsters is get them trained up more and more employable in that period. And so what we wanted to do is create a program that encouraged that process of getting kids up the employability ladder and up the training ladder to some extent. And so we put in some sub-programs, you know, like apprenticeships, you know, another 100,000, you're talking about. We really, I mean, the programs that the last speaker was talking about was exactly the kind of thing we're very, very keen to do. And but the structure is that those kids will go to the providers, and the providers will put them out in various of these sub programs, whatever they are, and they will be encouraged to do that with a real eye on what will optimize the opportunities for that kid, because When he's finished that program, he's coming back to the provider, and the provider can then earn money on placing them in the market. So there's a real interest for an intelligent use of the time, of the downtime by the kids. Those sub-programs, we've talked about having 100,000 extra apprenticeships, and clearly, the detail of doing that, you heard just now, it's about widening both the demand and the supply for doing that. We're going with this program called Work Pairings, which is a kind of, actually, when you think about it, it's a bit like a medieval apprenticeship, although it's short. We're just looking at... The trouble with all these programs, of course, is that your risk is that you distort the economy. You do more harm than good. And so the idea of work pairings is we found a group that didn't employ anyone anyway, the sole traders. So we could just attach a youngster to a sole trader for 6 months, and they would both, they'd get huge experience and value. And we devised that through those rather basic economic goals. And lo and behold, when we looked around, we found a pilot that actually did exactly what we wanted, was superbly successful. It has 80% of the people doing that go on to an apprenticeship, and of course had been utterly ignored in an atmosphere where you've got so many pilots, no one can assess what works and what doesn't. So young apprenticeships we want to get, so we want to pull it right back into the schools. Boost the university places only by 10,000, that's all we could afford, we'd like to do more. The other big thing we want to do is reintroduce self-employment. That used to be running at £100,000 people a year. It's collapsed to 5,000, this is people out of unemployment into self-employment. And we want to kind of push that right back up. And again, the way we want to do that is by creating a network of business mentors to help the people get into self-employment. It's not about money, self-employment. It's a lot about knowledge, and it's a lot about being directed into the parts of the economy which are growing, not the bit of the economy you've just got made redundant in. So that's the main problem about self-employment. You tend to reinforce economic failure unless you have a mechanism to direct people into the bits of the economy which are going to grow, where they have got skills, although they may not realise it. Finally, our idea is to encourage what we're calling work clubs, and that is basically self-help. In austere times, you cannot afford to ignore the benefit of people helping each other. And so these work clubs are not, you're all familiar with job clubs. The idea of a work club is that it's more than just looking for a job, it's actually looking for upgrading and skilling and training as well, and people helping each other to do that. I think we're seeing more change in welfare to work than we've ever seen before, and I think that that revolution is set to continue and even to accelerate. And it's happening really at three levels. It's happening firstly at the social level, social revolution. We are reactivating now the economically inactive, and we have to do that. We have to, reactivate the people who are the most difficult to help, even though we are in the middle of a difficult recession, where the cyclically unemployed will tend to take first place. We've got to do both at the same time. We're creating revolution in terms of real accountability by an industry, by this industry, and removing the tyranny of targets, and just letting people get on with their outcomes. And I think, with luck, we'll create a really effective industry in this country, focused on what works, and it'll be able to extend what works, I think, in two ways. A, it can go international, because a lot of people around the world are looking very closely at what we're trying to do here. But secondly, we can use this approach in other parts of this economy. The justice system is an obvious area, in order to spread this payment by outcomes. So there we are.
That's great. Thank you very much.